So here on slide 3.9 in the Pointers chapter, the third chapter, there's a discussion between direct and indirect addressing. You're already familiar with probably most of this. You're certainly familiar with direct addressing, although you may not be consciously aware of it. When you are using variables, you are just plain simple variables, you're doing direct addressing. The compiler, when it translates your program, it builds up a table called the symbol table. And inside of that table, it stores information about each identifier. It stores their name, it stores their type, it stores their address location that it decides to allocate to them, to assign to them. And then, when you, for example, if you say x equals x plus 2 in your code, it automatically looks up in the symbol table, it looks up the address of x. And on the right-hand side of that assignment for that addition, it generates a machine language instruction that tells it to fetch or get the contents of the memory location for that variable, which is basically to get the value of x. And then it generates the add one, and then it generates a store operation to store the result of that computation into the address of X. And it does that automatically. So direct addressing is one level of memory addressing, and we don't really have to think about it because it's basically automatic. It's built right into the language. When you use a variable, you're referring to that variable's value. You're not referring to its address. And the language treats it as though you are referring to the variable's value. Now, with pointers, however, pointers don't really contain values. Pointers contain addresses. So we have another level of addressing. It's usually referred to as indirect addressing. Basically, that means that if we dereference a variable, if we have, like here at the bottom of this slide, I've got I pointer equals the address of X. Well, now if I say asterisk I pointer plus plus, which is legal, asterisk I pointer, to be safe, I probably ought to put that in parentheses, plus plus, to increment what I pointer is pointing at. All right? When the compiler would come to that code, it would basically have to put in a double fetch and store operation. It would first put in a fetch operation to get the contents of the memory location at the pointer. Okay, so in this case, to get the contents of the value that's at F4241. So it would then get that address, then it would include instructions to take the value that was at that address and then do another fetch operation upon the value of that. Well, what's at F241 is F, or F4241 is F4240. So now it does a fetch on that one, which gets back the value of 28. And then it adds one to it and stores it back out there. So it has to do basically two fetches when you're dereferencing pointers. That's indirect addressing. Nothing really complicated about it. You just have to be aware that there is sort of this small little access penalty that the code has to pay. It's more than offset by the advantages of pointers. Now here on the next slide, there is a little discussion about pointers to structures. We can set a pointer to point to not only a simple variable, but to also point to a structure. So here we've got a simple little rect-type structure declared with an integer, a float, and a character. And we define rect pointer to be a type that is a pointer to a rect type. So rect pointer is a type of pointer to rect type. And then we can declare an instance of rec type, rec 1. We can declare an instance of a rec pointer, R1 pointer, and we can set it to the address of rec 1. Perfectly legal. Now, R1 pointer is pointing to that rec 1 structure. That rec 1 structure, rec 1, is just the name of that structure. In reality, of course, rec 1 is a variable that has an address somewhere out in memory, which is where that structure is located at. And R1 pointer is a variable, and stored in R1 pointer is the location of where rec 1 is at. Now that then allows us to access the fields of that structure by going through the pointer. We dereference the pointer. We can use the asterisk operator, the dereference operator, and we place that, of course, in front of the pointer as before. But now, since it's pointing to a record, if we just say star or asterisk R1 pointer, we would be referring to the whole record. And if we want to do record assignment or some aggregate operation upon the entire record, that would be legal. But if we want to then access a particular field, we have to use the structure member operator, which is the period and follow it by a field name. That's the same thing you've learned previously for accessing records. No different. Now, however, it turns out, as you can see there, I've got parentheses around that star rec pointer 1. I have to have parentheses around to get that to work correctly. Because if I don't, the compiler will try to dereference the fields. The reason that it tries to do this has to do with what's called the precedence of those operators. Now, you're already familiar with precedence of operators, at least with arithmetic operators. If you have a arithmetic expression, something like x plus y times z, which gets done first? The multiplication, right? Why? It has higher precedence, right? It has higher precedence. And the language is designed like that to give it higher precedence. Well, it turns out that the language is designed to give the asterisk, and mainly because of the multiplication, it gives it higher precedence than the period. So in order to force it to carry out the dereference first, we would have to put parentheses around that. However, and you will if you look at some old C code, see this type of notation. And it is a bit clumsy. And the C++ Standards Committee cleaned this crap up. They basically added an arrow operator, which is a minus and a greater than symbol. And it takes the place of the dereference and the pointer. When you have a pointer that's pointing to a structure, or to a class for that matter, when it's pointing to a structure, you can follow the pointer with an arrow and then reference the field, and you don't have to bother with doing the asterisk in front of it, the parentheses, and the period, and then the field name. It's just a shorthand notation. That's all it is. It cleans up the language syntax, and you don't have any problem with having to worry about the precedence of the dereference operator being lower than the precedence of the member operator. Question?
You referenced the star R1 pointer in the front view, but is that higher priority than the period?
The asterisk has higher priority than the period. I've lost my laser pointer, but I've got another one. Yes, this has higher precedence. Since it has higher precedence, if the compiler sees an expression like this, It tries to perform the operator with the higher precedence. So it would try and derest. I take that back. I said that just the opposite, didn't I? The period has the higher precedence. So it would try and dereference, and it actually would do this, and you would run into all kinds of problems. It'll actually go to the address of the pointer. It'll add an offset to it for that field, which will get you to who knows where in memory, and then it'll try and dereference that, treat it as a pointer. So ignore all of that. Don't worry about all of that crap, and use the arrow operator. Okay? Questions? That's pretty straightforward. Nothing really complex about that. Now we are going to get into something.
When you say a pointer, does it create anything to the data type?
No. When you declare a pointer, all you get is memory for the pointer.
Where does it point to the beginning of the
array? It is undefined until you give it a value. Just like any integer. If you say int x, what's the value of x? After you've said int x, what's the value of x? You don't know. It's undefined. If you say int star p1, p1's undefined. Same thing. No, it does not automatically initialize it. And if some compilers do automatically initialize them, you shouldn't rely upon that. Okay? Alright, so here on slide 311. We now come to the concept, one of the main concepts of the language, in that arrays are actually pointers. Array names, array identifiers, are actually pointers. Array identifiers are considered the same as pointers. They're pointers that contain the address of the zeroth element of the array, usually referred to as the base address of the array. So you can see those little declarations we've got up there. I've got a character array of size 20 called name, and I've got a character pointer. Now right after that declaration of the character pointer person, it doesn't point anywhere. It has no initial value. I can assign pointer equals to name without indexing that name, without indexing the array. That's doing pointer assignment. That's setting the pointer value that's in name into person. That is equivalent to saying person equals the address of name sub zero. Those are equivalent assignments. They accomplish exactly the same thing. They store the address of the zeroth element, the base address of the array, in the person pointer.
So if you wanted to assign all of the elements in the array to one pointer, is that possible, or do you have to...
No. A pointer will only hold one address. Okay? A pointer will only hold one address. If you had an array of pointers, you could do that. I'm not sure if it would be useful, but you could do it. You should be aware, of course, that setting person equal to name, for example, does not create a copy. In a sense, I have now what's called an alias. I now have these two variables that are referring to the same location in memory. You're already familiar with this. Where is another instance of how, where you learned in 1044 in the prior programming class, of where two variables could be referring to the same memory location? Anyone?
Reference parameters.
When you pass something by reference, you're passing its address. So that the formal reference parameter is referring to the same memory content, same memory location, as the corresponding actual parameter. Same thing here in this case. Now, because arrays are pointers, the language designers decided to allow pointers to also be treated as arrays. Since you can treat array names as pointers. They said, let's just let pointers be treated as arrays. So therefore, not only can we index arrays, we can also index pointers. We can follow a pointer by an index. And it will treat it as if it was an array. It'll behave the same. It's only meaningful to do if the pointer is pointing at an array. It doesn't necessarily have to be pointing at the zeroth element, but it better be pointing at an array. Now, what that means basically is that if it's pointing to the base address of the array, the zeroth element, and I index it, it would be the same as if I was indexing the array name. It would work out to be identical. Okay? If I was to decide in that code up there, for example, if instead of setting person equal to name, I could set person equal to the address of name sub 10. Okay, that gets just a little tricky. If I set person equal to the address of name sub 10, and then I say cout person sub 0, what would be printed? Huh? Name sub 10 would be printed. Because when you index a pointer, the compiler, the language, assumes that it's pointing at the beginning of the array. Whether it is or not, it doesn't care. It's going to treat it as though it's pointing to the beginning of the array. Okay? Another crucial point is, what happens if you index a pointer and it's not pointing to an array? Anybody want to tell me who's done it before besides me? Okay. You want to tell us what happened? You want to tell us what it does? But does it tell you that it's out of bounds? No. It goes ahead and assumes that it's pointing at an array. And if I was to set person up there equal to some, let's say I had, let's say if I set person up there, no, I'm not going to tell you about that yet. If I set person up there, if I had some simple character variables, let's say I defined character char x comma y comma z, okay, and then I say person equals address of y, and then I say person sub 1. What do you think I'm outputting? Z. Maybe not. There's no guarantee. You don't know. Maybe not. Depends on how the compiler decides. Instead of Z, I might be outputting X. Some compilers will actually, because of the way they allocate the memory in sort of reverse order, it might be X. And then others, it might be something entirely different. Who knows? The compiler's not going to care. Okay? But even worse, if I was to then say person sub 10 equals person sub 10, person sub 10 equals quote space quote, it's going to go 10 down and treat it as though it was a character, and it's going to stick a value of 32 or whatever, the space 30 in there, whether it really is a character being stored in that memory location or not. And then at some later on point in your program, later on, when you're accessing that location through another variable and you change it, and the program blows up, and you're looking at this line of code, which is maybe another function or two down, going, now why would that blow up? Okay, it blew up there, but that's nowhere near where it actually, where the problem is actually at. Okay? So, the reason I'm harping upon this so much is that it's one of the chief problems that C++ programmers have to sort of deal with. Pointers are a very powerful concept. Pointers give us great programming power, but they are also dangerous, okay? It's as if, you know, if I was going to go deer hunting and someone gave me a bazooka, okay? Now, okay, I'm deer hunting now, buddy, and I don't have to get that close. Oh, there's one over there in that field? No problem. Boom! Okay? I'm a lot more dangerous running around with that bazooka than if I was hunting with maybe a bow and arrow. So that's the problem that you have to deal with. It gives us a lot more power, but we have to be a lot more careful about how we wield that power. One of the offsets of using pointers is that we said if we don't want pointers to point to anywhere, we store what point, we store what constant value in them. We store null. Well, null has a value of zero. Well, a lot of times you'll see code that looks a little bit something like this. If not person, or that's a pointer. Well now, if person is a pointer, if that is null, it has a value of zero. Zero is considered what? Logical value. It's considered to be false. Not false would be true. So that's saying if that's a null pointer. It's sort of saying like if not pointer, if this pointer is not valid. Okay, that's sort of what that check is saying. Now you could just as well check to see if person equal null. But if you want to do it, if it makes more sense to you to do it like that, go right ahead. Okay? For some compilers, this code will generate just minutely slightly more efficient machine code than comparing it to null. Alright? But it's such a minor difference and it only works on some compilers, it's probably not worth it. I mention it because you will see a lot of code like this, where some programmers will do this. There's nothing wrong with it. Perfectly valid. If person is not null, then what's the result of that if statement? That whole if statement is false, because if it's not null, that means it's non-zero. Any non-zero value is considered to be true. Okay? Any non-zero value is considered to be true. Question?
Is actually a pointer to an array. Is there any way to set that?
Name actually is the array, which contains the pointer of the array.
Okay.
Right, slight difference, but whatever. Okay, so, is there any way to change name?
Oh, no, I was asking if you could set null, but I guess you can't.
No, you cannot. You cannot change the address that's stored in an array pointer. You can change the address that's stored in a pointer to an array, but you cannot change the address to an array pointer. Everybody understand? In other words, I can say person equals name. I can say person plus plus, which we'll get to in a moment. I cannot say name plus plus. Or I cannot say, even if I say person equals name, I cannot then on the very next line turn around and say name equals person. If I try and do that, the compiler will go, no, you don't. Okay? It will not allow that. We'll get to that. Name is a constant pointer. Alright. A little bit about where this memory comes from. So far, what we've been talking about is sort of the basics and the mechanics of using pointers. We haven't really allocated memory so far. We've been setting pointers to existing memory. by setting pointers equal to the addresses of other variables that we declare, that we define. And that's not really the way pointers are used most of the time. The reason that I just went through those previous 11 slides or 10 slides doing that is because it's simpler to understand. It gets us into the mindset. It's a way of more easily introducing the basics. But now we have to come to the question of when we really need more memory, how do we get more memory? How do we tell the system we need more memory? Well, the way we do that is we use a function in C++, a supplied function called new. And we can follow that by a type name. Okay? We can follow that by type name. And the new function will go out into memory and carve us up some memory, the amount that's needed to store a variable of that type. It will return us back the address of that memory. And it'll also essentially keep track that memory is now used by our program, and it's not used by anybody else. That's the way we do allocation in C++, is with this new function. In order to do deallocation, once we've used that memory and we're finished with it in our program, in the execution of our program, if we're able to determine that we don't need that memory anymore, we can say delete. We can use the delete function, follow it by pointer name, by pointer variable. The compiler will figure out what type that pointer is, what type of memory it points to. It can figure out how much memory, in a sense, that pointer is pointing to, and it will deallocate that memory. It will take it away from our program, and it'll basically mark it as no longer being used so that it can be reused. Let's worry about on this slide 312, let's worry about the left-hand side of the slide first, and let's not worry about the right-hand slide. We'll come back to the right-hand slide. Right-hand slide, right-hand of the slide. So you can see here an example. I've got a name pointer, or a character pointer called name, and an integer pointer called IPointer. And I can say name equals new no throw sub char. That's new char. So we go down into what's called the heap, the free store. And it picks off a byte or whatever and marks that as being used for our program and returns me back the address, which is then stored in name. The no throw parameter to new, by the way, tells us not to throw an exception. Now, we aren't going to discuss exception handling in here. Exception handling is sort of an advanced OO concept where you have to do try and catch clauses and other things. And we aren't going to cover it in here. But to prevent the compiler from accidentally throwing one that we aren't going to create our programs to handle, we're going to tell it don't throw one. Okay? So we're just going to pass the no throw parameter to name. And you don't really need to worry about it. You'll learn about that when we get to 2704. Now, and then for IPointer, now, of course, with name, that allocation of name by new only sets name to point to one character variable. That's all. All I could store, if I dereference name, I can say star name equals quote something, quote some character, quote. I can store one character in there, but that's all. That's all the memory I've got. However, on this next program that you're going to be working on, I want you to actually allocate a whole array. And the way we do that is quite simply is we tell new to allocate us an array. We say new node throw, the type of the array, sub, and then in parentheses, we can give it a variable, a constant. We can tell it how many of these memory locations of this type we need. And it returns us back the array address, which is the base address, or the address of the zeroth element. So in this case, it'll go out into the heap, pull out 20 integer memory cells that are consecutive in memory, and it'll return back the address to the zeroth element, which gets stored in iPointer. And then I can use iPointer as though it was an array. I can index it, whatever. When I'm through with those and I deallocate them, to deallocate a non-array pointer, I just say delete pointer, delete name. Now once you delete something, once you delete a pointer, the value stored, according to the language standard, and I always keep using that phrase in here because that's what we sort of try and teach for the most part in here. We try and teach everything to the standard. The compilers, usually, in almost all cases, the compiler writers have very meticulously implemented the standard. But sometimes they don't. And they have very good reasons usually when they don't do that, but sometimes they don't. However, the standard says, and most compilers do this, after the execution of a delete statement, the pointer that was passed to delete is undefined. Okay? It's undefined. And so, to be good programmers, you should get into a habit of after you delete a pointer, if you're not going to reassign it immediately to point to something else, you should assign it to null, okay, so that it's no longer undefined, just to be safe. And in order to delete a pointer that's pointing to an array, I say delete brackets and then the pointer. And that tells the compiler that this thing's pointing to an array, and it figures out how much to delete. I could also say delete bracket with the dimension and the pointer. That would be okay too. It doesn't really matter. Be careful that you don't put the wrong dimension in here. Now, unlike array declarations, if I have an array declaration, non-dynamic, a static array like you defined in the last program, right? For this next program, I want you to allocate an array dynamically that is large enough to hold the input file plus 25% more of the records. Okay? So in the compsys.txt file, let's keep it simple and say that thing contains 10 records. If that thing contains 10 records, then I would allocate how many? 12. No, I didn't say round. Truncate. In the spec, it says truncate. So I would allocate 10, an array of size 12, if there were 10 records in there. Now, previously, so you're going to have some section of code that goes, that you're going to have to do multiple passes through that file. You can open the file, go through, and count up the number of lines that are not comment lines. Okay? You'll have to have a section of code that opens that file up, counts the number of lines that are not comment lines, closes the file, and returns back that number. That number will tell you how many records are in the file. You then multiply that by 1.25 or whatever, you truncate it, and then you set some size 25 equal to that. can I normally, if I've got an integer called size 25 that I just set equal to the result of some computation, can I after that then say something like, you know, compsys is the name of my structure. Compsys space compdb sub comp size or whatever, size 25. Can I declare a static array using an integer variable as the dimension? No. The compiler will complain. Why? Because the compiler doesn't know at compile time what's going to be in that integer variable, and therefore it can't figure out how many to allocate. So it won't let you do that. However, you can do it dynamically. You can declare a pointer to your compsys type, and you can say that pointer equals new no throw compsys sub some integer variable. That's how you will do it. Except instead of the structure type now, you'll be using a class type. Alright? To define your class, no big deal. You take the word structure and you replace it by the word class. Okay? Above all of those member declarations inside your class, you put the word public, right? No, private. Okay? Those are private data members. And then you put the word public down below, and you define your function members. Okay? Your function prototypes. And then you can use it almost like your structure. You can certainly allocate an array of objects dynamically, no big deal. Almost the same as allocating an array of integers. But they'll behave like objects. Now, I should point out to you too that when, this is actually an advantage, when you define, and you know this, when you define an instance of an object, what automatically executes? Huh? The constructor. If I don't give any parameters following the name of that object declaration, which constructor automatically executes?
Default.
The default constructor. The default constructor automatically executes upon every array object that comes into existence. So when I say something, if that right there where I've got I pointer equals new no throw int sub 20, if I take that integer out and I had set I pointer equal to be a pointer to an object type, and then I say, you know, I pointer equals new no throw of whatever object type sub 20, at that point I now have 20 objects. And each of those 20 objects has automatically had the default constructor executed upon them, so that they're all initialized. The initialization takes place automatically. For those of you who had functions in your last program that looped through and initialized your structures, get rid of them. You won't need them. Okay? The constructor will take care of that automatically when you define or when you allocate the array of objects. Okay? Now, just to sort of round out a little bit of your education here in C++ and C, in this class, we are going to use the C++ allocation functions, new and delete. If you look at some old C code, you may see programmers who have used the dynamic allocation and deallocation that was in C before C++ added new and delete. Those functions are called malloc and free. For malloc, what you had to do is you had to tell it, malloc basically didn't do anything, didn't figure out for you how much memory to allocate. You had to tell it. And you had to tell it how many bytes to allocate. And to what normally C programmers did, and are still doing for some of them, they used the sizeUp function. The sizeUp function takes a type, be it an integer or structure, doesn't matter. It takes a type, and the size up function returns the number of bytes to store, a variable of that type. And then if you wanted to store an array, you would multiply that by the size of the array, and you would tell malloc to give you that many bytes. Malloc, by default, returns an untyped pointer, a pointer that has no type, sometimes referred to as a generic pointer. I catch any of you using generic pointers in here, and I will have the GTA take a red paintbrush to your code when they grade it, okay? Generic pointers are typeless pointers. They are highly dangerous. The compiler does absolutely no checking for you. The compiler basically assumes that you are the almighty programmer and that you make no mistakes whatsoever. And if you do make a mistake, the compiler couldn't care less. Okay? It'll do absolutely nothing for you to help you figure it out. So, don't use generic pointers. You don't need them in C++. There are ways that you will learn in 2704 of anything you could do with generic pointers in C, you can do with virtual pointers and abstract classes and all kinds of good stuff that you will learn about in 2704. So don't worry about it. But what that meant in terms of the old C code was that you would have to then typecast the typeless pointer that malloc returns. So you would have a prefix here, and you'd get the type star, and that basically told the language to assume that this is a pointer to int, or a pointer to character, or a pointer to some struct type. And that's the way you would type it. In order to then deallocate it, you would just call free, and it really didn't matter whether it was an array or not. So, don't worry about that. That's not the way we're going to do it in here. Here's an example of allocating an array. I've got int size. I'm going to input from the keyboard size, an integer. Basically about the same as if I had computed size. I can then set name star equal to an array of character of that size. I can set scores, which is a pointer to an integer, to an array of integers of that size. I can then change size. However, the fact that I've changed size after the allocation doesn't change the amount of memory that was previously allocated to those arrays. Those arrays only have the amount of memory that was allocated to them at the time of the allocation for the value that size was at that point in the execution. It doesn't automatically resize them when the variable that was previously holding the dimension of those arrays suddenly changes. Okay? So, you could see here, for example, you know, we might have scores having this memory location, and since integers take up 4 bytes, this would basically be the addresses in hexadecimal as we go through the first 5 locations in the array. The storage space gets allocated contiguously, one right after the other, for a dynamically allocated array. Here on slide 314, I can use these things. I can use an array like any statically allocated array. There's an old C string function called strcpy, which will copy a literal string into an array of characters. I can do this if I include C string, not string, but C string. If I include C string in my function, I can call string copy. We are going to use them. I just used it in here for example purposes. I could execute that function upon the name pointer because it now points to an array of characters. I can go through the scores with the I can go through that array that's now been allocated to scores by indexing it here, treating it as though it was an array. I could actually pass it to a function. Here's a function called sort scores, and I'm passing it scores. The prototype of sort scores. What would have to be the type of the first parameter in the function prototype for sort scores? Speaking in C++, which you don't really want to wander around the streets of Blacksburg speaking in C++, okay? People will look at you very strangely, and they'll certainly know you're a computer science major. Not that that's a bad thing, okay? I'm joking, okay? You can smile or laugh, whatever. You can ignore me if you want to, and just go ahead and sleep. It's all right. Nobody's answered this question yet. What will be, I've given you some time to think there, okay? Not just vegetate, all right? What will be the type of the first parameter to in the function sort scores? Yes?
That would probably be an array of integers.
I said speak in C++. Can I write array of integers? So tell me in C++ what it would be.
It would be a pointer to an array.
I can't write pointer to array in C++ and hope the compiler will understand me. I want you to actually tell me the code. Are you saying int star?
Yes.
Okay. That's one possibility. There's another. Huh? Int bracket. That's right. Int bracket. I can tell it I'm passing it an array. Do it care? Nah. I'm passing it an array, a pointer to an array, so that's valid. I can pass it into an actual variable that's been defined, a formal parameter variable that's been defined to be an array pointer. No problem. Now there's some differences, subtle and minor, but you can do it. Okay? And sometimes it's quite useful to do that. Alright, so in order to, of course, to deallocate them, there's how I would deallocate them. If I had done, you got to be careful about this. Inside of a function, if I've got a function, not main, some other function, and I've got a bunch of little temporary float variables that I've defined, simple float variables, or an array of floats, not a pointer, an array, I have a static array. When that function comes into existence, those variables come into existence, right? They're called automatic variables. They are defined locally in the function. When the function begins execution, they come into existence. They have storage. When the function finishes execution and the function goes out of scope, what happens to that memory? What happens to those variables?
Freed up.
They no longer exist. The system reclaims them. Okay? That's the concept of automatic variables. They automatically come into existence, and they automatically go out of existence. That's automatic variables. That's not the case with dynamic variables. If I'm inside of a function, and I allocate an array of integers, or an array of floats, doubles, I'll check. And then that program, and I don't delete it, and that function goes out of scope, what happens to that memory? It's laying around, but I can't get to it. unless I've actually sent its address back from the function, and you will want to do that at times. But if I don't send its address back from the function, if I don't return its address, if the pointer to that array was defined locally, and now that pointer variables are automatic variables. They have a limited lifetime. They exist, the pointer variables, the memory that stores the address, they exist for as long as the scope of the block, be it a function or whatever, they were defined in. So they have a limited lifetime. So if I've defined the pointer to the array that I've allocated dynamically inside of a local function, locally, and that function finishes execution, and I don't return back the value that was stored in that pointer, I have what's referred to as a memory leak. I now have memory that's associated with my program that got allocated to it, but hasn't been automatically reclaimed, and I have no way in my program of getting back to that memory. It's basically now a hole out in memory. It's now a hole out in the memory that's allocated to my program, and I can't do anything with it. This is one of the chief reasons why programs bomb, okay? So the chief reasons programs bomb is that they have memory leaks. Now, if you're not careful, memory leaks can basically deplete your available memory. So you've got to be a little bit, you've got to make sure that if you, for dynamic memory, when you allocate it, you've got to make sure at some point in your program, when you no longer need it, ideally, you deallocate it. And be a little bit careful too. If I've got an array like name up there that I've allocated dynamically, if I say just delete name, and I don't tell it that that's an array that it's deleting, some compilers will gracefully say, that's okay, I know what you meant. I'll deallocate the whole array. Other compilers will go, I don't see any brackets, so I'm just going to assume that's a simple variable that you're deallocating, so I'll just deallocate the first zeroth element of the array. And you'll still have a memory leak in your program. Okay? Now, something you are not going to have to do on the program you're writing now, but that you will have to do on the next program. On the program that you're going to start working on now, on the second program in here, you will have to allocate an array dynamically. And you now know how to do that. You will have to allocate an array dynamically, but once you allocate it, you will not resize it. Okay? You will not need to resize it for this program. For the next program, you will. For this program, once you've set it to be 125% of the size of the number of records that's in the initial compsys.txt file, you'll never resize it. And if adds occur that would try to store too many records in that, you'll stop them from occurring. Okay? However, on our third program that we'll be working on in a few weeks, the excitement never ends. On our third program, we will actually eliminate this, restriction such that adds will automatically resize the array so that it will expand during execution to be as large as it needs to be. The way we will do that is quite simply like this. We will determine, maybe through computation or whatever, how much larger of an array we need. We will then use another pointer, a different pointer, and allocate another array that's larger. We will then use a for loop that will go through for the size of the old array, the capacity of the old array, and it'll copy into the new array each of the elements in the corresponding position in the old array. Now, the new array will be larger than the old one, unless we want to shrink it. We'll also do shrinking, too, on the next program. But we will then store each of those elements in there. Then we will delete our old array. And then we'll reset the pointer to our old array to be equal to this new array. And then we can go ahead and null out that temporary pointer that was pointing to the new array because we don't need to use it anymore. And that's how we resize an array dynamically during execution. There's no great trick about it to get to a certain extent. When you have string variables, when you declare a string object, and you store a string inside of that string, you store characters inside of that string, and then later you store more characters, and it automatically grows. This is basically the way they're doing it. There's no great trick to it. Questions?
Yeah. Why is that really going to happen?
No. If I say delete new array, I just undone the allocation that I did. Okay? Now that actually brings up a good point. If I had set store is equal to new array here, after I allocate my new array, I copy it over, I delete the old array, I set store is to the new array, and then if I make a mistake, and rather than saying new array equals null, I say delete bracket new array. At that point, new array is undefined. But what about scores? Is scores undefined too? No, it's not. But unfortunately, scores is now pointing to an area of memory that has been deallocated. That is termed a dangling pointer. That will get you in trouble. Okay? That will create lots of problems. That, like I said, pointers are powerful, but they're dangerous. A lot of memory leaks occur because of dangling pointers. You have to be careful. That's why, in order to avoid dangling pointers, you clean up any alias pointers that you have. So here on slide 318 is a little discussion about that no-throw parameter. Traditionally, in C++, heaps are only so large. They're actually quite large, as a matter of fact. How large is a heap? Typically, on most modern machines nowadays, a heap, it depends upon the size of your own program. It depends upon the size of the generated executable code and the amount of static data that your code has allocated to it. Your whole code executes most commonly nowadays on 32-bit memory address machines. Not on the Itanium chip, okay? On most 32-bit machines nowadays, compilers set up your program as though it's executing in a 32-bit memory space. A 32-bit memory space, if memory serves me correctly, is about a 2 gig memory space. Now that's a virtual memory space in a lot of cases. If you don't have 2 gig of memory inside of your RAM, which most of us probably don't. Wish I did, I don't. Okay. Wait a minute. No, No, I don't think I do. I've only got a gig. Bummer. I need more memory. The first machine I ever started working on had 4K of RAM. 4K. Count it. 4,000 bytes. That's it. No more, buddy. That was it. I thought I was in seventh heaven when we upgraded it and we went to the large memory model. We got 8K. If you had told me back in the late 70s that one day I would have a machine sitting on my desk with a gig of memory and I'd be going, I wish I had 2 gigs, I would have laughed you out of existence. Okay? So, traditionally, when there's not enough memory, you've really got to be doing a lot of big allocation nowadays to be exhausting the heap, running out of dynamic memory. But it can happen, and you should program, no matter what program you're doing, if you are allocating dynamic memory, you should always, even if you don't think there's any chance of it occurring, you should at least program for the possibility that the heap will be exhausted. And so, traditionally, C++ returns a null pointer when the heap is exhausted, when there's not enough available memory to meet your request. However, the standard changed a little bit ago, and instead of returning null, the standard says that it may or may not return null, but the standard requires that they throw an out-of-memory exception. Here's an out-of-memory exception. And that's just what your program has to do to it. Catch it and handle it. We aren't going to talk about that in here, as I told you. So, the standard, they did provide a way that by passing the no-throw parameter to new, that it will guarantee that null gets returned if the allocation fails. And then we can always check that afterwards. Afterwards, we could check to see, at this point here, we could check to see if my list equals null, equal null. What does that tell us? If my list equal null, that tells us what? That it did not get allocated to it, that it failed. And we better do something about that. Most of the time, if you're in a function, and the function says return a Boolean variable whether it succeeds or not, the only thing you'll probably be able to do is say return false and I'm out of here. So you might have something like, after that, if my list equal null, what can I do? Return false. That's all I can do. Otherwise, you might do the rest of the operations that the function needs to do. I have too much code to talk about in the short amount of time I have left. I'll see you on Tuesday.